The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. You're with Mike Ryan on today's News Talk Radio. TNT. TNT.
And it's a Monday. Can you believe it? A Monday already. Weekends are just far too short. Let me tell you. And if I was Prime Minister, President of the entire universe, or even of the WHO, I would declare that Mondays do not exist. Do not exist. Disgusting things they are. Anyway, reality says that it is Monday. Now, what about this? Well, we're all talking about the Chinese balloon, as my grandmother used to say, balloon. And multiple Chinese spy balloons have entered the US before the recent incident, according to the media. One crashed off the coast of Hawaii 4 months ago, while another traversed Texas and Florida years ago, according to Fox. Sources told Fox. Now, what is certain, what is true, was that those reports are not true. They're lies. But what's new? The news should be something like, media tells more lies. Media creates the narrative, because that's what it is. It's all a lie, the whole thing. But any way they can get to disgrace or make it look as if Donald Trump was way worse than Joe Biden, any way. So he had one balloon, and there were two balloons for maybe Trump. Those terrible, terrible, evil balloons. And we may have more tomorrow if we can get hold of this, but this is not the end of it. I mean, think about it. It's a balloon. But think about it. Imagine the damage they could do if a jumping castle got loose. I mean, could you imagine 38,000 feet up, this jumping castle loaded? Well, the person that had it was loaded, and that's why it got off the rope. Could be armed with 3- and 4-year-old kids screaming for help. I mean, it's a terrible world we live in. One day a balloon, the next day a jumping castle. What next? I mean, who knows? I mean, the world is crazy. Next, you'll be telling me that Joe Biden is the president. Oh, that's right, he is the president, but he doesn't know it. Now, James O'Neill has much more on this for us. James has something that's developing in regards to, because the Chinese said that was a meteorological balloon. Well, James has told us that China has assured that the warships heading for Taiwan are just meteorological warships.
Thanks, Mike. The Chinese Communist Party has assured world leaders that the massive fleet of warships heading toward Taiwan is just checking on the weather in the Taiwan Strait. Wei Fenghei, China's Minister of National Defense.
All right, not to worry. Those are simply meteorological distortors. And the bomber circling overhead. They are just monitoring cloud pattern. Relax, everyone.
Upon sighting the ships, Taiwan immediately alerted the United States that the incoming warships might be used for war. However, President Biden was quickly reassured by President Xi Jinping that any explosions in the Taiwan Strait were simply part of a very intense meteorological mission. Mr. Xi said they can use artillery shells launched towards an island to learn more about which way the wind blows. Not a joke, said President Biden. That's tackling climate change right there. Now, to be honest, I'm not sure how aircraft carriers help learn about the weather, but President Xi said not to worry about it. I can't wait to see what all he does. President Xi announced that the Chinese Communist Party has developed several new units recently, including meteorological tanks, helicopters, and grenades. We plan to deploy these weather units all across the globe, said President Xi. We've learned much about the weather in Hong Kong, and now it's time to study Taiwan. The Chinese Communist Party appreciates America's patience while we battle climate change, one country at a time. At publishing time, President Xi assured Biden that the intercontinental ballistic missiles flying overhead were simply meteorological missiles.
Oh,
Back to you, Mike.
Thanks, James. Are you wearing your lead outfit and your tinfoil hat? Now, don't miss out on a thing. Be sure to download the TNT Radio app from either the Apple App Store or Google Play so you can easily listen live to us anywhere, anytime. It's available right now to download. Keeping you up to speed, this is TNT Radio.
News and talk you can count on.
I can rely on them.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Now, the M1 Abrams tanks that Washington recently promised to Ukraine may end up being a liability rather than a boost to Kiev's war effort. Rod Stephen joins me. Rod, tell us more.
Mike, the story has come out in the Financial Times, and they say such a view is explained by the armour's overcomplicated logistics and maintenance needs. The paper says the 70-tonne tank has a gas turbine engine, which allows it greater acceleration than a diesel, but it requires meticulous maintenance and consumes larger amounts of fuel. The paper also cites former US Army platoon commander John Nagel, who says his soldiers spent a whole lot of time literally banging out air filters during the 1991 Gulf War and the 2003 US invasion of Iraq amid big concerns about the tank engine ingesting sand and not working properly, Mike.
We'll give you a tank, but it doesn't really work. It's just like the Germans. They have 130 of those and 88 of those don't work. I mean, I'm just wondering there whether they're being given the leftovers and the optics aren't all that great. What's all this about, Rod?
Well, the tanks are apparently going to need a steady supply of spare parts. Mm. And because they have 500-gallon tanks refilled that need to be refilled every day with jet fuel, given they can't run on diesel, now this former commander says the M1 Abrams, great tank, but it's an American tank. Mm. And the American way of war demands all the logistics in the world. The paper then notes that the logistics and supply network for the Abrams tanks would stay in the United States. Now, there's a guy called John Kirshner, who's a managing director of Beacon Global Strategies, which is a strategic advisory firm. And he says the logistical shortcomings might eventually turn the Abrams into something of a liability for Ukrainian troops, as they could easily fall prey to Russian attacks, Mike.
Mm. I'm just thinking, though, the jet fuel. I mean, I'm sure they've got a lot of that there. Where's the tank? It's flying at 13 inches at the moment. But so what else is being said up? Are there other people voicing their concerns about these low-flying tanks?
Yes, Mike. Back in December last year, the Pentagon also argued that M1 Abrams tanks were just too difficult to operate when it refused to supply them to Ukraine at that time. But then Washington changed its mind, which happened last month, promising the 31 Abrams tanks to Kyiv. Yet the hardware isn't expected to arrive in Ukraine for several months. Russia has repeatedly said the West against supporting Kyiv with weapons, arguing that doing so will only prolong the conflict. That's what it's warning at the moment, Mike. Mm. And commenting on the deliveries of modern tanks to Ukraine, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says that they'll burn like the rest of Western weapons.
You know, it's really interesting also. I was looking at a cartoon the other day and read the story that they're saying that a bunch of the tanks that were left behind as a parting gesture of inefficiency and incompetency from a Joe Biden when they departed Afghanistan. Those tanks, which are the Abrams tanks, there was this cartoon and there was a Ukrainian guy next to his Abrams tank. And next to him, just on the other side, was this Russian guy with his Abrams tank. And they're both looking at each other with this, you know, really weird stare, like your tank's the same as my tank. One wonders, though, here's the thing. If the Russians do have those tanks from the Afghanistanis or from the Taliban, and if the Ukrainians have those tanks, one side knows how to look after them, and it obviously ain't the Ukrainians. So as they're being attacked, could you imagine, what's this button for? What button?
Yes.
Or next thing is, which is reverse and fast? I mean, some of the, they say some of the Italian tanks from the Second World War, which my father used to tell me, the Italian tanks had one forward, five reverse. And that was just my dad telling me those terrible stories. So maybe the same tank or the same sort of gearbox could be there for the Ukrainians, because we know that they're getting a walloping by the Russians, and they could have all. I mean, look at the Leopard tanks from Germany. Oh yeah, they don't work, but anyway, enjoy. I mean, the whole thing is just all optics, isn't it?
Sure is.
Yeah, Rod Stephen, thank you very much. I took you into different paths. Then I apologise. I'll try and be good next time. Rod Stephen on TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Alan Miller.
You campaigned for quite some time. Tell us a bit about the first round of impositions, because we now know it's been in all the press that Philip Glanville, the mayor of Hackney, is saying 75% reduction in cars. But how did this all start?
It was just the way that they were imposed without any... I mean, there's such major changes to the way we go about our lives. It was almost like the biggest changes in London since World War II. And yet we weren't told. Hackney did this 10-year transport plan from, I think it's 2015. I just dug it out again, had a look at it. There are no mentions of low traffic neighbourhoods. They do not mention them at all. And if you look at the results, there's about 54 people responded. This is an entire London borough. They reorganised the whole area for the next 10 years on 54 responses. And that's the utter breathtaking arrogance of all of this. It's almost hard to believe.
Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Wokeness is infiltrating churches, and people don't really know what's hitting them.
Critical race theory assumes that racism is everywhere, it is in everything. These ideologies have crept into the church.
I have grown up with this invisible kind of bag of privilege.
And I know, as a white pastor, I have blind spots.
Reparations fits into the scope of the gospel.
It's a racist worldview. You're swimming in racism.
The social justice warriors say, if you're white, you are racist. And if you say that you are not a racist, then you have to be a white supremacist.
I see within evangelicalism today an attack on the very gospel itself.
Social justice doesn't have to do with justice. It has to do with Marxism.
Wokeness is now the dominant academic paradigm on many university and college campuses.
Many of our Christian universities have fallen prey.
I went to an all-black school, raised in a black context. Everything was oppression. White people are racist, cops can't be trusted, and this world is not for us, it's against us. We felt like the government owed us. I have a family, I have children, and I don't have a job. I was just, it was at the darkest point in my life.
Because I was white, would we have to divorce and separate due to my skin color?
Christianity enables people to find forgiveness and redemption. However, Marxism is completely vindictive.
There is no redeemer and there is no redemption in the religion of anti-racism.
I believe that the evangelical church today is going to have to make a decision. Are we going to submit to the culture, or are we going to remain true to the faith and take the consequences?
How the left is stealing your church. The invasion of the gospel of woke at salemnow.com.
Billionaire globalist corporations will own everything. Homes, factories, farms, cars, furniture, and everyday citizens will rent what they need, if their social credit score allows. Lighting the fuse for freedom, TNT Radio.
Now, the Premier of New South Wales, who once dressed up as a SS guard, his greater crime is he's impersonating a Premier. Anyway, he likes the idea of renters who cannot find housing moving in with retirees. That's right, you leave your parents' house and go and live with granny or your neighbour or people of the same age. Nuts. Now, the idea to fill thousands of empty rooms in Sydney homes by electronically matching older homeowners with younger renters. Well, that's interesting, almost like a dating site without the dating. Or maybe, who knows? Now, this was floated over the weekend by SGS Economics and Planning. They're a trendy company, amen, who love to talk about their values and doing good. I think this has merit and is at least worth discussing. Dominic Perrottet said last week, in fact, he said today, not last Monday, today. This is another great example of economic efficiency and great social outcomes being two sides of the same coin. I wonder if these very people are recommending this idea to their families. What about a tent? I mean, raise Tent City. They're only a couple of $100. Plonk it on your neighbour's front lawn. Have a jamboree. Martin North is Principal of Digital Finance Analytics, which combines primary consumer research, industry modelling, economic analysis and segmentation and analytics to offer insight into the dynamics of the mortgage, lending, savings, payments and superannuation industries. Digital Finance Analytics make daily YouTube shows on property and finance at Walk the World and analyses housing and mortgage finance for the DFA channel, blog and mainstream media. First of all, Martin North, thanks for joining us once again.
Hello there. I love the idea of a jamboree.
I do too. I don't know about the neighbours. You know, years ago when they were talking about the Australia being not invaded by but an oversupply of Afghanistanis and all that sort of stuff and how caravans have been plonked up, a friend of mine moved over from Hawaii and moved up to Palm Cove in North Queensland. And I sent him a make-believe text, and it was something from like from Muhammad or something, that we have our caravan coming up, the caravan being many, many people, and we'd like to camp on his front lawn. Would he mind? Anyway, he didn't take it very, very well at all. He thought I was for real. Sent me this thing back. You'll be charged with trespass and everything. But here's the thing, though. In Australia, there is a housing shortage for renters. And in New South Wales, this sort of seems like a the optics of, you know, we'll explore certain things for the renters out there and we'll come up with a solution for you. What do you think of this idea? And what could go wrong?
What could go right? Look, I think the first thing today to say is just remember we are about a month away from the election. So to my mind, it's funny how, you know, funny ideas come out just before elections and then disappear after the election. So That's the first point. There is a real issue, of course, with housing in Australia. And we know that rental supply is a very significant problem. You know, the vacancy rates are very low. Rents have been rising quite fast. And we've got migration turning back on again, a lot of students coming in, particularly for the new academic year. And a lot of those students are going to hit the main urban centres, including Sydney and Melbourne. So there is definitely a problem with finding people somewhere to live. And many people can't afford to find somewhere to live. And the other side of it is we know that we have quite a lot of people who've lived in properties for quite some time, quite often big properties with lots of rooms, and they've now, families gone away and moved out, and so they've got lots of spare rooms. And one of the interesting questions then is, what do you do? You know, do you try to find a smaller property? Do you downsize? Well, that's quite costly, can be difficult, and quite often you can't find somewhere to rent or to live where you'd want to live. So the downsizing story is a problem as well. So you've got these two things. And then what they've said is, well, hang on a moment, can we put two and two together and make four? Well, I think you're probably putting two and two together and making about 6.5 because, Of course, there's a couple of issues. The first issue is, is it going to be voluntary or not voluntary? Are they going to actually put incentives in place to, from a tax perspective, for example? And what is it that you do? So if you find somebody, for example, who's living one of your rooms and actually from a conduct perspective doesn't really behave very well, you know, what recourses do you have? It just feels to me that this is a think tank policy thrown out just before the election without any real thorough thinking. The problem we've got is that the property problem that we've got in Australia, not just in New South Wales, is 30 years in the making. And neither state nor federal governments are willing or able to address the fundamental issues that we've got here. And this is another example in my mind of a little bit of sticking plaster stuck over the wounds, trying to solve this little bit of the problem. Now, there's a few issues why we've got the issue. We have, firstly, of course, the banks were encouraged to lend. You know, the lending criteria were, well, they were released and allowed people to borrow much more. So we've got a lot of people in debt. Property prices rose very quickly because of the fact that you could borrow a lot more. And the banks love that, of course, but that got more people into debt. And then the interest rates were taken really low by the RBA over the last decade or so. And so we had this situation, the perfect storm, where we had low interest rates, property prices rising, and then we had the COVID cycle, and then we had a lot more liquidity thrown in by the government, the home builder, all those things. All of that created a massive run-up in property prices and a whole bunch of difficulty. And then, of course, we've now had the RBA turn around and say, right, they're going to put rates up. They're probably going to again tomorrow. And so we've suddenly got this new environment where rates are rising very high. Property prices that have been way, way too expensive have come off. Now, it's interesting. The Productivity Commission did a big review last year about housing affordability and what was going on. They concluded all of these so-called solutions, whether it's first home buyer grants or, you know, shared equity schemes, they all only do one thing, and that is they push property prices in the wrong direction and make it less accessible for people to get into the property sector, because you might get a few people in, but not many. So the problem we've got is no one wants to talk about the structural issues here. They're all looking for quick, easy solutions. And I regard this one as a quick, easy solution that probably, when you think about it, probably won't work that well.
Now, I think the police should be called. Someone's in there. You know, if they have, especially if they're getting on a bit, and you know, they forget things. And like, what are you doing in my house? But I'm paying you. Who are you? Hang on. Hello. Hey, do you think this is a cry for help from the Premier, or is it an admission of failure?
I think it's an admission of failure. Look, none of the states, nor indeed the federal government, will admit that they have been the people responsible for creating the problem in the first place. Because they always blame, for example, the federal government blamed the states for not allowing release of more land for building, right? The states will blame tax policy and negative gearing, which is, of course, a federal issue, right? And then, of course, the states also go down and blame the local authorities for the planning rules and regulations. And then the developers, of course, developers are very expert at getting into the ears of, the local planners and the local councils. They're part of the problem too. The trouble is we financialize property to billio, and we're looking at it just purely as an asset, like a financial asset, which means that all of the decisions are only being taken through a narrow financial lens, rather than the real issue, which is housing is not something that only those who can afford it should be able to get. Housing should be a human right, in my view. And we should actually have a societal structure that is there with sufficient capacity to provide housing for all of those who need it. Now, that's a very different philosophy, and that would take you down a very different path. Part of the problem we've got to do is we've got to defuse the very, very high household debt bomb that's there at the moment. That's going to take time. We've also got to deal with this issue of many older people in big properties who would like to downsize but can't because there aren't actually suitable properties for them to move to. This needs joined up thinking. It needs joined up thinking between states and feds, and it needs a long-term plan. It needs a strategy beyond the election cycle. But no, we keep getting short-term fix-it uppers in line with election cycles to try and just win a few more votes. It ain't going to cut the mustard.
No. Martin Author is my guest from Principle of Digital Finance. Back with Martin in 1 second. This is TNT Radio.
What a news day this is turning out to be.
Let's finish it.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. Dozens, if not hundreds of people are feared to have been killed after a powerful earthquake rattled the Middle East and southern Europe early on Monday morning. The Pentagon has given Ukraine the green light to fire its long-range missiles at will, allowing them to use the new HIMARS rockets however they wish. And Washington's come under fire after allowing what it claims to have been a Chinese spy balloon to fly over key military sites for days before shooting it out of the sky.
globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
And my guest is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Martin, before we get into that, just the balloon. I'm just wondering, maybe if you can just tell me if I'm getting warm. That balloon, it was the end of the Chinese New Year celebrations. I'm wondering if that was one from Beijing that just got away.
I have to say, I think it's been very conveniently used by particularly people in the US to, you know, prosecute a broader agenda. We don't really quite know, of course, and it may just been a weather balloon. It might be something more. Of course, all of the US media have said it's a spy balloon. That's what they're calling it, not a weather balloon. So I don't know.
But just think, though. I mean, imagine if they were attacked. I mean, they had trouble shooting down a balloon.
Well, they had to wait for it to go into the sea, you know, rather than over land.
That's right. And then poison the fish. Anyway, we'll get back to things that we know more about. Tell me about the facts of the rental market. It must be worse than it's ever been. That's what it feels like.
Well, I think it is pretty bad. Now, what's interesting, of course, we had a very significant decline in rents through the COVID period. So we had a lot of people who couldn't let their property out or could only let it out for a relatively cheap money. We had a lot of Airbnbs who came back into the rental sector. So suddenly there was a big surge in supply and rentals dropped dramatically. So part of the problem is that we're measuring rents from a very low base that was artificially depressed because of the COVID episode. So there has been a very significant run-up. We've also, of course, opened the migration taps quite strongly, and we've got something like 300,000 coming into Australia from a migration perspective, mm-hmm. which is putting more demand on it. And as a result of that, we've now got the situation where there is very tight supply, something like 0.9% across the greater Sydney region at the moment, which is a very low supply level. Now, if you look more closely, it's not universally the same. There are areas where there is much more supply. There are other areas where less supply. It also varies whether you look at houses versus units. The other thing that's happened is about 20% of property investors have quit the field. The reason they've quit the field is that now with interest rates rising and with no capital appreciation in property, they don't think it's a good investment. So we've actually got less property available. But here's another interesting fact. When the census was run last year, across Australia, there was more than 1 million vacant properties. In other words, people not living in them. And there's a big story that nobody wants to talk about why it is that there's lots and lots of vacant property, for example, in Sydney and Melbourne. I'll give you an example down in Melbourne around the new development areas around the Docklands area, right? There's a lot of evidence that a lot of those high-rise properties were bought but have never been lived in. And they were often bought by offshore purchasers. The reason they're holding them is because they believe that there'll be capital appreciation. So they deliberately don't let those properties out. Now, I would like to have a conversation about vacancies and vacancy rates in the context of all that vacant property that's around. There's a lot of it about. So rather than trying to sort of do a fix up between renters and elderly people who's probably going to invalidate their insurance and all sorts of other weird things, what about having a proper discussion about property vacancy and how we actually get that property back into the pipeline? Because that million properties across the country will go a long way to solving the rental affordability issue that we've got.
I'm just thinking, though, the more interference from the bureaucracy or government, that's probably the last path we need to take. We probably need to find a way of encouraging these owners or these property owners to do something with the property, either use as a rental property or sell it or do something, because just to sit on all these apartments, and if there are a million of those at least in the country, that would most likely fix up the whole schmozzle. Mm. It may also, though, reduce the profitability of an apartment. If you have a glut of too many apartments, one, the value will decrease. So what do you do?
Well, that's part of the issue. So a lot of people were holding property. And look, it's like a second-hand car. As soon as you drive a new car off the forecourt, it's a second-hand car, and you immediately generally start losing value. The same with new apartments, right? When it's brand new and no one's ever touched it, it tends to hold its value better than if you've actually got somebody in it. So the thinking from many people was, well, I'll buy the apartment, I'll just keep it vacant, I'll keep it locked up. And, you know, over time, property prices will rise, and that means that it's a capital appreciation. And, you know, we had a 20% rise in 1 year, of course, and or more. And so people were thinking, yeah, this is great. But it shows you again that you need to have joined up thinking here. I agree with you. You don't want a lot more government intervention into housing. We've had 20 years of too much government intervention, too much what I call neoliberal thinking applied to property. Mm. What we want is a normal market where supply and demand can actually work, where in fact you've got enough freedoms to be able to actually do the things you want to do without all the government interventions. But then you've got the tax breaks, right? I mean, with higher interest rates, negatively geared property investors are going to get a huge windfall because of the fact that they're going to be paying more interest, which means they're going to be able to offset more tax. So guess what? Anybody who doesn't actually own an investment property, we as taxpayers are effectively subsidizing property investors even more. So what we need to do is we need to unpick all of this government interference over the last 20 to 30 years and bring the market back to a much more balanced view where it's a real market, because it's not a real market at the moment. It's too stuffed by regulators and by governments and people playing different things. You know, even things like the shared equity schemes around the world, they have proved not to be very effective. We know the first owner grant schemes just lift prices. We seem to want to meddle, and come back to the reason, political. It's all political. It's all trying to get votes. That's the problem. We've actually made property a vote issue rather than actually, you know, what it should be, which is a housing supply issue and a housing demand issue. So the lens is wrong.
Mm. What about councils? If you have to move out, now there's problems associated with that. One, you may not want to do it. Two, you got to make sure there's the infrastructure in place so that you can get to your work if you're, you know, 40, 50, 60, an hour and a half away. But if you could have a good infrastructure in place, such as very fast trains, good, better roads, better, you know, so that the roads flow more evenly and faster. And then you moved out into some of the rural areas or the borders of the city. If they made land more available, would that help ease the problem, or do you think it would create too many other problems?
Well, certainly so far, the new developments further out have only been properties without the proper infrastructure. So, you know, if you talk to people in Western Sydney, for example, as I do quite often, a lot of them have no alternative but to have two or three cars because there's no other transport options other than driving. And, of course, the cost of fuel is pretty high, and three cars is a big impost on people. So the problem is, again, it's lack of joined-up thinking. If we'd actually drawn a picture out to say we're going to actually create a series of communities around our major cities, and in those communities we're going to put in place all the major infrastructure that we need, from schools and hospitals and shops and everything else, and we're going to put a public infrastructure in place to be able to support, then it would work. But what we do is we simply say, right, well, we'll peel off a bit more land, and then the developers come in and squeeze as many properties as they can on as smaller plots as possible. They don't want to let up any land for green space or, you know, invest further on the infrastructure. So again, it's through that commercial lens, which means we don't get the right outcomes. So we have majorly stuffed up from a planning perspective here, as well as from an economic perspective. And unfortunately, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be creating ghettos where we're going to have a lot of people who spend a hell of a lot of their money just on somewhere to live, without enough money perhaps to get around and do the things that they want to do. And it becomes basically a story of you go to work to pay for somewhere to live, to go to work.
But the local councils have an answer for that. They'll create an LTN, a low traffic neighbourhood. Sorry. So they'll create the LTN. So therefore, those people in that, say, 15-minute city have got to either stay in that city, or if they want to get out, they use one road. So therefore, the infrastructure doesn't compensate for the amount of traffic. And it would make then living in that area even more expensive and most likely harder. So I think we are in, as they would say in the classics, a deep doo-doos. I mean, it's a bit like having a boat and boat says it holds 10 people and we have 15 in it. You know it's going to sink. Who do you throw out? Where do we go from here?
Well, I mean, first observation, Australia is a massive country, right? How is it we don't have enough land for property
climate
to
change.
Be developed? No, I think it's more to do with the fact that land is actually rationed. The people who own the land are rationing it because they're not prepared to give it away other than at the very highest price possible. So we've got the wrong commercial lens on it first. Secondly, you've got a high-rise development because it's cheaper to build 100 units up rather than 100 units across, right? Because basically it's just a smaller footprint and that it means it's cheaper to start with. So there's a natural inclination for developers to build up rather than to build low rise, despite the fact all the research says low rise is better from a lifestyle perspective. And then you've got this issue of all the cash flows that run between the developers and the councils and the states and all the development fees, all those things. That's all part of the muddy underbelly as to why it is that property is actually, you know, completely stupid. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It is one of the most stupid things we got. You know, and the fact of the matter is, we've let it go for 20 or 30 years. Nobody wants to really tackle it strategically. The last review was just like all the others. Wasn't really any outcome. So what you do is you end up with these little tactical solutions just ahead of the election that sound good on paper until you actually start to think about it. And there's no real appetite to address the fundamental structural issues we have. We have to do that, though, because ultimately we're going to end up with less livable Australia and we're going to end up with more people spending more of their money just on somewhere to live. And that's sort of not necessarily good from a sort of a human perspective, from a social perspective, nor indeed from an economic perspective.
Yeah, I'm just thinking when Labor get in New South Wales, and they will get in, I think, because there's that movement at the moment. When they get in, it'll be basically a total, except for Tassie, it's going to be a total Labor-run country. And one could probably surmise that on the horizon is a government that will start becoming more involved in our own personal space and lives. And socialism-communism could become even more of a reality, because the best way to do it initially is for the government to say, we own that block, we own that block, and we own that house and that house, and we've owned it now, we're going to do what we like with it, and those people can come in. You may not have a whole lot of money, you may not own a place, but as Klaus said, you will be happy. Martin North, now isn't this scary? Martin North, if somebody wants to find out more about you, which way do they head, north or south?
Now they go to Walk the World on YouTube or digitalfinanceanalytics.com.
Thank you very much. This is TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
The issue of trans women being allowed to compete in sports with biological women is not going away anytime soon. Recently, World Athletics proposed continuing to allow transgender women to compete in female international track and field events. Among those who will be directly impacted by the policy is British shot putter Amelia Strickler, who says it would leave women at a serious disadvantage. She spoke with BBC Radio 5 Live and warned that this will be in elite athletics sooner than we think. Asked if she would accept the outcome of the World Athletics vote on the issue, which will be held in March, Strickler said, well, it's just something that me and my peers and my colleagues, we don't want to see this happen. BBC Sports noted support for Strickler's stance from British Olympic long jumper Chris Tomlinson, who tweeted, male athletes need to stand up for women before their sport is ruined. My question is, and has always been, where are the feminists? Where are the women's libbers who have now deserted women athletes in the name of woke garbage? Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Carbon monoxide is a colorless, odorless gas that can be fatal. Don't use anything indoors that burns fuel, such as gasoline-powered generators, camp stoves and lanterns, or charcoal grills. Opening doors and windows or using fans isn't enough. Have your vents and chimneys checked to make sure water heater and gas furnace exhausts aren't blocked. If you feel sick, dizzy, or weak while using a generator, get to fresh air right away. From the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
Here's what
what I wanted to add to that conversation.
The conversation continues.
They just mean well, but they can't do any better what they're doing.
On today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Alice Springs, like many other communities, has been coping with escalating crime and, in particular, youth crime. Governments more and more seem unable to solve the problems they are put there to solve, despite increasing taxpayer support. Last week, a meeting was organised by one town resident to air community concerns. While this is a positive move, this should not have been necessary. Garth Thompson has been a resident of Alice Springs for 44 years. It doesn't look a day over 44. He called the meeting and was brave to do so. Garth, thanks for joining me.
No, thank you. I appreciate the time.
Look, why did you call the meeting? I mean, we've seen the reports, and I am just roughly familiar with Alice. Hadn't been there for like 40, 50 years. But Alice Springs was quintessential Australian. What's happened to it? Why has it gone south?
Mate, Alice Springs is an amazing town, but we're facing some major, major problems from the neglect of our government to step in and ensure that we're living in a safe environment. I put my hand up and called the meeting, not as the front to any group or any political background or anything like that, out of just pure frustration and concern that someone was going to take actions into their own hands, destroy their own life or more, take someone else's life or something like that. The amount of physical and verbal abuse that is now becoming one-on-one and face-to-face with people in town has people scared and concerned to go into town shopping. Just spending time in town is extremely nerve-wracking for a lot of people. Our supermarkets were getting to the point that they were shutting at 7 o'clock at night before it's dark because their staff weren't safe to go home. There were so many things that were just letting get run out of control, and our government just refused to step in and wouldn't do anything to acknowledge the problem or try and help cover the problem or provide welfare for these kids that are out on the street. To have 150 to 200 to 250 kids running amok in town, destroying the place, smashing shops and cars and breaking into people's houses with machetes and things like this, none of it is exaggerated. It turned into a 24-hour-a-day problem. And it was just destroying our town. And basically, we as a group of locals needed to stand up and start putting things in place to save our own town.
Yeah, but you were portrayed, I'll play this quick grab from a magnificent person, not, and I'm being facetious, Noreen Young, who's the Associate Dean of University of Technology in Sydney. I'll play this part. I wanted to vomit when I heard this.
If you saw that room in Mississippi Burning, for example, Australians would say, how terrible. Oh, that's terrible that happens there. The vitriol and racism and lack of regard and respect for those people on their land while those people were living off the bounty of it was appalling.
Now, she lives in Sydney. What the hell would she know about Alice Springs?
Absolutely nothing. So I've been called all sorts of things since the airing of the ABC report. And to be honest with you, I don't have an ounce of respect left for anyone involved with the ABC. They are just nothing but disgusting human beings. And they had the perfect chance to help us bring life back to our town and show how varied the group of people were that were there. At least 20% or more of the 3,000 people that showed up to our town meeting were Aboriginal. Now, this meeting came about from me, just myself, putting a Facebook post up saying we've started the process. And then I put a radio ad on, asking, and I ran it for 4 days, asking for people to come to a meeting. With no one else promoting it, supporting it, organising it, and we had over 3,000 people when we have a population of 25,000. This was just spoke volumes in itself as to how much people are dealing with this, how much they want to see our town go back to the amazing place it is. The love for this town, and it's just, it is so apparent that people want to see the town become decent and good again, and get the culture thriving and change people's perspectives of our town. It's a sad thing where it's gotten to, and the way it's been portrayed while we're trying to bring something positive and bring positive interaction back into our homes is just very sad.
Mm. The other one, I just want to play this again. It's the hype from the ABC. And then I want to ask you a question. I'll just play this first of all.
It was really a disgusting show of white supremacy.
And it was clearly all around white supremacy and the safety of white people in this town.
And I am way more concerned about the danger posed by those people in there, those white people.
Now, just first of all, for those that can't see the audio waves, they were white. But anyway, I've got to tell you, it's like, wow. How many drinks did I have last night after watching that? But the thing is, it's not about colour. It's just about crime. I mean, but yet the ABC and a lot of the woke Australians, and I would imagine, I don't know where Natasha Files is, but they make it about racism. It's nothing to do with racism. It's about community, isn't it?
Absolutely. And just one thing to bring up there, that the ABC did not even speak to me. They classified in their story the organising group of small businesses that want to get compensation to cover their own costs. Now, they didn't speak to me. I'm the only organiser. They didn't even think to ask if I've got any Aboriginal in me. They haven't even asked that question.
Well, have you?
That's for people to work out, mate.
Mm. But you know what? Here's the thing. So what? So what? So what? I mean, it's exactly. Not about race or colour. It's about crime. It's about it's community.
Not. It is, and it's about accountability on why the product that the government has available to them, being the different services, the different avenues, the different ways that they can provide care and welfare for these kids, the way that they can cover the reasons why they're not attending school, the reasons why the families aren't looking after these kids. There's processes in place that need to be followed, and the government simply are not following them. They're neglecting us. The alcohol issues, there is no way that the town can deal with the alcohol problems here with the resources available. These people that have alcohol problems in their lives, like any drug or substance abuse, we don't have the support services here that are strong enough to back them or to support them or to help them. Our government is so concerned about these kids being on the street that they're seen as being Aboriginal before they're being seen as a child that needs welfare and care and a safe home. There are so many things that they're just so scared to put their hand up and say, we've made a mistake, this is how we need to approach it. And that's what we're going to come together with as a community, as a group moving forward. We're going to start asking those questions, and we're going to demand answers, and we're going to hold them accountable for it, because they're the ones that put their faces on the posters and said, pick me, I want this job. I want you to pay me with your tax money to do this job for you, and none of them are doing it.
So what about the government led by, I mean, she's she's even better than Gunner, Natasha Files, I think it is. I mean, what are they doing about it? I believe I read somewhere where you were going to present her, or you're thinking about presenting her with a large amount of money to be, I think it was $1.5 billion. That's a fairly sizable chunk of change. First of all, is that true? Was that just a off-the-cuff moment?
That is definitely on the table. So we've already formed a group. So from the meeting moving forward, what I took there was the simple fact of compensation for Alice Springs residents. The last census report, we had nearly 12,000 rate-paying addresses in Alice Springs. We have around 2,000 small businesses, even though that number is just flat out going backwards. And then we've got our sporting groups, community groups and organisations and stuff like that.
Mm.
So I worked on a figure of 15,000 points of compensation at $100,000 per point. Now, we've got people that have lived their entire lives here that are spending huge percentages of their superannuation and life savings to secure their house because they don't feel safe in it. It's not right that people need to be living like this. It's not right that a woman should be woken up with a machete at her throat in the middle of the night demanding car keys. These things are just disgustingly wrong, and it's not an exaggeration. This is what we have been living with. And it needs to stop. Our government needs to step up and they need to be held accountable for it. The government set the benchmark on paying out compensation to the detainees of the detention centre in Darwin, the Don Dale Youth Detention Centre. They paid out $30,000 per head in compensation there for mistreatment. Now, Alice Springs has been living with mistreatment for a ridiculous amount of time, but these last 3 to 4 years have been absolutely wrong, and the last 12 months, it has just become plain scary. That is why everyone in Alice Springs is living as a victim. And we, across the board, have put a straight through $100,000 per point, whether it's a business, whether it's a home, whether it's an occupant renting the home. It's an even playing field for everyone. For us to bring our town back to life, we need to revitalise it ourselves. We need to get out there. We need to get our economy going again. We need to get the love of our town on show again. And we need to get the culture back.
Tell me this: if you had, if you were, say, if you were the king of Alice Springs, what would you do to fix it?
There's so many different points that need attention. That is the very hard part. As a group that has just come together, one of our big problems is that just to try and get help to ring through the 000 or to ring through to the police station to speak to a police officer is impossible. We get transferred to Darwin and then they have to interpret our addresses and street names and suburbs and stuff like that through Google Maps before the people in Darwin at the call centre understand what's going on. One of the big starting points that we need is we need our call centre back here in Alice Springs so that people have got confidence in ringing the police and actually reporting these problems. The welfare of these kids, Territory families really need to step up and become involved in the judicial system and the bail system and intercept these kids when they come out before they're bailed. The NT families need to be interacting with these kids and working out who is responsible for them. And then checking on their background, checking on their welfare, checking on their living conditions. The list goes on and on and on and on. There's not just one or two simple little answers to fix the town at the moment. It's become extremely sad. We're losing out on national events. We're losing out on tourism. We're losing out on so many things because of the neglect and just sitting back and watching it happen. The day that our Prime Minister came to town, our town was emptied. Different organisations and town councils and stuff like that, not the Alice Springs Town Council, we have quite a few different Central Australia councils that work out of Alice Springs. They removed around 300 to 400 people out of town that just hang around 24 hours a day. They were taken, just vanished out of town. Barbecue lunches and other events put on for them and everything else, keep them entertained for the day. So the Prime Minister couldn't physically see how we have to live every day. That is the single biggest form of acknowledgement from our government that they are more than aware of how things are in Alice Springs and the way things are and the way that they're controlling them, but that they accept that that's how we're going to live, but they don't want that to be seen. They need to be held accountable.
Do you fear for yourself for coming out? I mean, you're saying some pretty wild things here. I mean, first of all, if they are moving people out for optics alone and then back to as it was the next day, I mean, I would think they're people, the bureaucrats and probably council and stuff like that, they should be hung, drawn and quartered. I mean, I'm from the bush myself, and yeah, you take them out the back of the shed and give them a hiding and tell them to lift their game. I'm just appalled. I mean, that is, I feel very, very strongly about this. That is a disgrace, and Australians don't act that way, but we are. We've got to fix it, don't we?
It was the single biggest insult that our NT government could possibly have given us. To finally hear that a bloke out of Canberra that's the Prime Minister that can go to wherever he wants, anywhere he wants, all over the world, putting on a show and everything else, was actually going to come to Alice Springs, it gave a few people hope that maybe something positive might come out of this. And keep in mind, this only got highlighted because our mayor is game enough to have stood up and said, bring in the Defence Force. We need the support and the help to save Alice Springs and to bring some safety back because our government is not capable of doing it. That is what highlighted all of this whole process. I'd already started the process during the week before to bring the town meeting happening. It was a coincidence that our mayor, Matt Patterson, stood up and said that. And it's full credit to him because he's game enough to do it and to say it. And that's where all this has been highlighted from.
What I'm saying is
not an exaggeration. This is what we have been living with. And there's video proof of it day after day after, or hour after hour, not even day after day.
Does he have the support of council, or is he a bit of a Robinson Crusoe?
I don't know the backing of the council as far, but our council group work together as one. And I've seen that happen before. I've been involved in meetings where 6 or 8 months ago we tried to put pressure on the council to bring in a curfew so that kids couldn't be on the street of an evening. Mm. Their hands are tied. They can't bring that sort of stuff in. But even back then, they were asking the question again and trying to put pressure on our government again to enforce a curfew here in Alice Springs to try and give us a break.
Mm. Look, Arthur,
and take control over this. So
we've just run out of time. If somebody wants to find out more, how do they do that?
Look, we'll have a website up and running very shortly called SaveAliceSprings.com. If people don't believe me, what we've been dealing with, jump on Facebook and check out Action for Alice 2020.
Garth Thompson, you know, we are going to do this very shortly and push your website. Thank you very much for your time. This is TNT Radio.